Welcome to Radio Survivor. We're here for the love of radio and sound. My name is Jennifer Waits.
Hello, everybody. Eric Klein here.
I'm Paul Riismandel.
And we haven't been with you guys in a while, so we thought it would be nice to get together for an episode. There's some exciting radio news, I think, and things that are kind of making me feel optimistic and enthusiastic about radio. So it seemed like a good time for us to get together and talk a little bit about low-power FM, college radio, archiving, interesting documentaries that are coming up about radio culture, and whatever pops into our heads because we haven't been together in a while. So thanks.
May I make a suggestion?
Yes.
I think this would be a great moment here in 2024 to quickly reintroduce ourselves.
Oh wow.
So folks know that we have some authority here, or at least some experience to call upon that gives us the right to even be talking about all the sorts of radio right now. Jennifer, please tell us a little bit about yourself.
Toot your horn for a moment.
Toot my horn. I'm Jennifer Waits. I write about radio culture. I'm especially passionate about college radio. I've been writing about college radio since 2008, and increasingly have become interested in the importance of saving college radio materials, focusing on history and archives. So I'm co-chair of a College Radio Caucus that's part of the Radio Preservation Task Force, which is a project of the Library of Congress. So that occupies some of my time. And I've been here at Radio Survivor since the beginning. We started in 2009 with our website, and then we started doing a podcast and now a syndicated radio show as well.
My name is Eric Klein. I worked at a radio station for roughly 10 years in my 30s, where it was KPFA, which is the flagship station of the Pacifica Radio Network, which is about to celebrate its 75th anniversary as the first listener-sponsored radio station somewhere. Yeah, I know firsts are dangerous, right? But I was about to say in the world, and then I swallowed my tongue. But a big deal that this idea of a model where the listeners to an audience of a radio station, podcast community, would give back to that piece of media, or in this case, an entire radio network, by supporting it with their own money, was founded in the wake of World War II by these groups of anarchist pacifists in the Bay Area, who then went on to grow the radio network to four other affiliate stations around the country. That's where I wet my beak with radio, and I've been helping produce this radio show and podcast now for many, many years.
Paul Riismandel here, and I've been active in non-commercial radio for about three decades now, I have to admit, which include a long stint in community radio, which caused me to investigate and learn more about non-commercial radio in the United States, especially community radio. I started a radio show and blog called Media Geek in the earlier parts of the 2000s, which turned into a podcast, which I syndicated up until 2009. I served for a time as a community radio advisor, a college radio advisor at WNUR-FM at Northwestern University. I presently am in the podcast industry. I worked for a time at Midroll Media, which became Stitcher and then was acquired by SiriusXM, working in research for these organizations. I am now the Chief Insights Officer at Signal Hill Insights, and we are a boutique research industry focusing on digital audio streaming and podcasting. And of course, I'm a co-founder of Radio Survivor, along with Jennifer and Matthew Lassar, beginning back in 2009. And also helped to co-found this podcast with Eric and Jennifer.
Yeah, Matthew Lazar deserves his own turn, but we'll probably skip him for now. His bio is legitimate. Matthew knows radio, but he's not here today.
A legit college radio historian, or a legit radio historian. You can,
yes.
Freudian slip, because I'm so passionate about college radio there.
Having published two books on the history of the Pacifica Foundation and the Pacifica Radio Network.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that that Matthew once said on this podcast that I found really amazing was that through your work, Jennifer, of being an enthusiastic supporter of the story of college radio, he realized that he would go back and he would seek out and add more information to his studies of the Pacifica Radio Network and radio history, knowing what he now knows about college radio because of the work that you do and that you share. Because college radio being young people, unpaid oftentimes, enjoying themselves, fun is often delegitimized in history over serious topics. College radio has not gotten its due in the like story of audio
right.
that it deserves. But oftentimes we've always found, because of your work on the show, like every time we talk to someone else, someone from some other place, a guest on Radio Survivor, when we turn the corner and say, hey, what's your radio origin story? College radio is their radio origin story 7 times out of 10. And they don't tell that story usually because college radio is not it's not the top of your LinkedIn profile. Let's say that.
And
much.
And college radio is probably the origin story for most other radio that we know of. I mean, that's a bold statement, but you know, community radio owes a lot to college radio. Internet streaming stations owe a lot to college radio. Commercial radio has learned a lot from college radio. So
yeah. And it goes back all the way to the beginning of radio in the 1920s.
Exactly.
It doesn't start in the 80s, as we often love to say here on
Exactly.
Radio Survivor.
Exactly. And you guys talked about your radio, your legit radio past. So I also have a radio past and present. And, you know, I started doing college radio in the 80s at my college radio station. And, you know, except for a 6-year period, I've been doing college radio ever since. So, like Paul, a very long time and continue yeah. to today.
Aside from Radio Survivor, which counts as legit radio, by the way, I took some time off of doing regular hosting duties, but currently have been hosting for now going on 3 years at Freeform Portland.
Yeah, which is a good segue,
Portland, Oregon.
Which is a good segue for me to say that what Radio Survivor generally does these days when we record an episode is we talk about low power FM radio, which is exciting. We talk about podcasting, especially community podcasting, podcasts that are oriented more the way we think about radio, which is a non-commercial framework. And radio history. We love to dive deep into radio history on Radio Survivor.
Which is a really good segue because I wanted to talk about a project I'm now working on. So now I was hired to be an assistant curator for a college radio collection, which is part of the Digital Library of Amateur Radio and Communications. And if you've been listening to Radio Survivor, you might recall that we did an episode about them, and the acronym is DLARC. So episode 335, we talked to Kay Savitz, who is the archivist, who is in charge of this Digital Library of Amateur Radio and Communications. And on that episode, we learned from them that that collection was far more than just ham radio. There was, you know, all kinds of other cool stuff in there, including...
Yeah, Kay impressively takes a very broad perspective on what amateur radio means. And it's rather wondrous how they're really bringing in so many materials. It's so amazing, of course, that they've brought you on board to help
right.
college radio.
Well, not to mention that by casting this wide net, they captured our podcast episodes, reached out to us, asked if they could archive our shows in their archive. Jennifer responded. We had then reciprocated because we loved what they were doing, had them on as a guest on Radio Survivor. And then the next bit of the story is, Jennifer, is that you, you followed up. You pitched yourself during the episode. It's quite wonderful. The question, I think Kay turned the tables on us and was like, I want to ask you what direction I should be going right. in as a detective. I'm out right. here searching for clues about radio history, looking for the truffles buried in the dirt of the beautiful things that were happening in previous decades in radio. And we all had ideas, but Jennifer had a long enough list of good ideas that that they were worth hiring.
I know. Yeah. So it turned into a proposal. And you know, the thing is, I'm out there, you know, talking to people about the importance of saving things, but I don't always have a location for people to, you know, take their things to. And sometimes people have given me things. And so this provides kind of a platform for that. So within this digital library of amateur radio and communications, now we have a college radio section, and we have over 300 items as of this week, which I'm really excited about, because it starts, stuff like this starts out slow, you know, a lot of outreach and waiting to hear back from people. I'm starting with publications. So publications from college radio organizations, like, you know, there were organizations like the Intercollegiate Broadcasting System, which still exists. They've been around since the early 1940s. So they put together these amazing magazine style newsletters over the years. So looking for materials like that, but then I'm also looking for things like zines that college radio stations are producing in 2024. And sometimes those are posted on a platform that is more ephemeral, hard to download. And so I think it's important to digitize things that have never been digitized that are really old, but also make sure to save some of these newer items that might be in a format that could disappear soon. So that's the tact I'm taking right now. So there's some radio stations that have agreed to let us add all of their program guides, which sometimes are these amazing publications that have interviews with musicians, have the program schedule. Back in the 80s, they might have been in these newsprint format and quite elaborate. And some of that sort of material now has gone onto stations' websites and blogs. But like back in the day, a lot of stations did these elaborate magazines. Some of them continue to do so today. So that's sort of where I'm starting. That's a lot of what these 300 items are. And I'm also adding things like college radio theses. Maybe somebody did a history of their college radio station, wrote a thesis about it. So adding things like that, as well as flyers and other ephemera, station correspondence. So yeah, just wanted to update people about that. That collection is archive.org/details/college radio for the...
You'll put that up in our show notes for this particular episode at radiosurvivor.com.
And maybe it's a nice time for you to tell the listeners, if they know of any information collections or ideas, what they should do with that. Don't keep it to yourself.
Yeah, reach out to us. I don't know. I never give my email address over the website, but you can reach out to us through Radio Survivor, through the website. You can find my contact information. You know, the important thing is I need to get permission from the rights holders for things before we add them to the archive. So that's part of the process.
That's the bottleneck.
Yes.
I'm looking at the top 100 of 1982 for KFJC FM, right there in the archive. Number one, XTC, Census Working Overtime.
There you go.
Haircut 100's on there. It looks like it's like a who's who of first wave alternative college radio right here, from Stiff Little Fingers to Killing Joke to Flock of Seagulls, all in the top 100 of 1982 at college radio station KFJC at Foothill College.
And a lot of stations did these sort of tops lists and also sent these lists to, you know, like record labels who would want to know how their artists were, you know, how their albums were doing at various radio stations. So I have some things coming that will be added soon that are along those lines of from a bunch of different stations that are kind of like that, sort of a newsletter style format where you're reporting your charts and your new ads to people in the industry. So, and you know, a lot of these things look really cool. They might have been mimeographed on, you know, brightly colored or different colors of paper. So it's, I love all the artifacts of college radio culture. So super fun. And I'm glad to share that with all of you.
Wonderful.
And in other, I guess, personal college radio news, I was interviewed for this documentary called 35,000 Watts that's about college radio culture. And the director, Michael Millard, was inspired by his time at KTXT at Texas Tech University. And so he created this film that talks about the history of that radio station, but also he interviews people from a number of other radio stations and talks about broader college radio history. So I was excited to get interviewed because I got to put in the plug for college radios older than the 1980s, as like Eric mentioned. And so that film, it was, you know, I shot my interview during COVID times and it's already completed. So they've just started making it available for screenings and it's playing at a number of colleges through college radio stations, often as fundraisers. So it previewed at Marshall University in February, and then coming up, it's going to be playing at, or as part of an event for the station at the College of New Jersey, WTSR, where Paul has a connection.
Yeah, that was my first station back when the college was known as Trenton State College. That's where I got my start in radio.
So it'll be playing there. And then it's going to play as part of a fundraiser for KSPC at Pomona College. And that was one of my alma mater stations. So I'm actually going to be there in person. There's going to be a panel discussion after the screening. And it's a fundraiser for KSPC. That's on March 28th at Pomona College in Claremont, California. And the 35,000 Watts website has information about all the upcoming screenings. So we'll put that link in the show notes as well. It's, you know, there aren't that many films, TV shows, books, et cetera, about college radio. So it's nice to see some attention for the culture of college radio.
Yes. Do you know if it's expecting a wider release beyond these individual screenings at different colleges?
I know they submitted the film to festivals. So I think it's kind of TBD about festivals and then what happens beyond that. So right. Stay tuned.
I guess you can find it at 35,000 watts as numbers.com.
Yep. And then I, you know, kind of the reason that I wanted to bring us together today was all of a sudden it seemed like there was this news like in the past week about a bunch of stations that were expanding in various ways. So, you know, to me, that's really, really cool and inspiring. So I live in San Francisco and there's an online only station here, BFF.FM, that's, you know, it was my 55th station tour. So I write about radio stations. I go and visit and do these field trip reports. And I visited that station in 2014 and it was in this really quirky space called the Secret Alley. And it almost looked like you were on a movie set for some Jules Verne pirate themed adventure. just really, really interesting. And, you know, since that time, they're founded in 2013, they've kind of become this force, you know, an online only station in San Francisco, but they seem to really have a presence. And I thought that they were very happy being online only. So was super surprised and excited to hear that they actually applied for a low power FM permit and they were granted one. I also didn't realize that there were going to be any spaces left in San Francisco for low power FM in this most recent window. So they're going to be expanding, you know, within the next few years after they build out, and they're going to be on 104.9 FM in San Francisco, along with some other, you know, previously granted low power FM stations from the last window.
You know, I think we'll talk about this a bit in a few minutes when we get more into this recent window of low power FM applications and construction permit grantings. But, you know, one of the things about radio is that there are only so many spots on the dial. and often in crowded urban areas like the San Francisco market, there are very few left. Even though low power FM, by virtue of being low power, 100 watts of power as a maximum, can take up a smaller little slice on the dial. In many cases, there still are no longer any slots left. Although there's churn, your stations go off the air, come back on the air, and such. And so it does seem it's great to see that there was a signal available in the San Francisco area still, because until 2013 there were none. And so it's great to see that there even would be one.
And then, I mean, this is almost, you know, so simultaneously news came out. Well, news has been coming out that KEXP, which is a non-commercial radio station in Seattle, it was originally a college radio license, but now it's a separate nonprofit that holds the license for KEXP. So they acquired a frequency in San Francisco that was previously a commercial radio station that had gone bankrupt. And so they're grabbing 92.7 and they're going to launch in San Francisco on March 19th. So it's going to be a while for BFF.FM to get on the air in San Francisco, but it's interesting to me that in San Francisco, we're going to have these new non-commercial radio stations, low power, as well as a former commercial frequency. And so KEXP, you know, the plan is that it's going to be the same programming, but that they're going to gradually launch a Bay Area local music show.
Yeah, be local. Oh, God. Yeah, I just want to crow a little bit about how much I love KEXP's like YouTube channel. I don't often, I'm aware that they are a great online radio station. You can stream them all the time. They have a certain, demographic that I fit into with like a 90s indie rock, but also, it's for younger people as well. But their YouTube channel is just incredible. The live music rock shows that they put up for free on YouTube from the KEXP studios are just like why community radio still matters. They're a little bit like NPR Tiny Desk in their aesthetic and their value to the culture. I just love to put those live performances on whenever there's a new one, or sometimes I scroll back into the old ones. It's a really great, it's just good music.
Yeah, and it's gonna be super interesting to see how they adapt that to another market in San Francisco, so stay tuned. And then on the East Coast, word came out this week that East Village Radio is coming back with the program manager, Brian Turner, who used to be at WFMU as music director and program director there. And East Village Radio, it was actually my fifth radio station tour. And it was like one of the tiniest radio.
Just to put that in perspective, Jennifer, you've toured 100?
No, 177, I think.
177 radio stations in the course of about 15 years. No, I guess 16, 17 years.
Since 2008. Yeah.
2008, math, 16 years.
KEXP was number 70. I forgot to give a shout out to that tour.
unless you're still working on one of them at this moment, 100% of those radio station tours are things that you've written up as blog posts, as the kids used to say, articles on our website, radiosurvivor.com. And you've also often brought the sound of those radio station tours, or at least the lessons you've learned or the stories you've learned here on the podcast. And it's always really neat how you, there's so much value in showing up in person to ask questions and meeting people and being in the space, when you go out on tour and come back with this information.
You get a totally different perspective. So East Village Radio, I visited in, in 2008. And I remember I had to stand outside because it was so tiny and they had a band playing with maybe four members. And it's like a closet, the size of this space on First and First Avenue and First Street. In the East Village. So it was an online station when I visited, but it was briefly a pirate station before that. So it was around from 2003 to 2014. And then it was brought back by Dash Radio from 2015 to 2016. So there hasn't been East Village Radio since 2016 in any form, and now it's coming back. You know, so that's interesting to be relaunching this kind of, you know, they had some famous musicians and DJs at the radio station. So when it was in its heyday, they had kind of a cool following. And it's right next to this and sort of part of this restaurant, Little Frankie's on First Avenue in the East Village. So, you know, radio is alive and well.
So, I mean, providing a little bit more background here, right? So East Village Radio is principally like a community radio, but focused really on music and music culture, right?
Yeah.
And certainly being based in the East Village of Manhattan, the East Greenwich Village, right? That's certainly still quite a cultural center where there are many, many clubs and many, many bands play through at this time. So that's sort of part of the significance there, right? It's similar to KEXP, which again is another very music-focused community radio station, both, you know, dedicated to say a broader swath, a broader, more variety, a more diverse lineup of music than is typically heard on most commercial music stations at this moment in time.
Yeah. And BFF.FM in San Francisco too, like all three of these stations I'm talking about all have a real independent music bent to them. So,
you know, that's something I think, you know, I think we've seen emerge, and this has been emerged really in the 21st century, has been non-commercial stations that are more dedicated to being able to play music, but really diverse music and really focused in a particular way. You know, in the 20th century, so to speak, but really, you know, prior to low power FM in many ways, it was very difficult, I think, for community radio stations to focus on music often because they might be the only community radio station in their metro area, in some cases across many metro areas, which meant that there was a lot of communities to serve in a lot of different ways. And so the need to sort of have talk programming, focus on different constituencies, some music programming, focus on different constituencies, but often prismatic in a very good way, but meaning that also, you know, it was the case that you know, you might be hearing hardcore punk 1 hour and you'd be hearing Indian ragas the next hour. And there often could be like a patchwork to it. And while I'm certainly not denigrating that style of radio at all, because it can be quite wonderful, it can also be frustrating from a listener experience.
Yeah.
Especially is different in the 1990s or in the 1980s when we did not have the number of digital choices that we have with the internet, podcasting, satellite radio, internet radio, etc. at hand, compared to what we have today in the 21st century. And low power FM opened up many more frequencies, allowed a city like San Francisco to have many different community radio stations. So it's not only relying, say, simply on KPFA as it did in decades prior, but could have now stations that can dedicate themselves to sort of independent rock musics or independent popular musics, really, I think we'd have to say at this point in time, because there are stations that can dedicate themselves to other sorts of, to more talk programming or other types of cultural programming. And that's a real flourishing, I think, that often doesn't get noticed in a way. Yeah. that, you know, because it's not just KEXP, there's like The Current, which is run by, I believe, Minnesota Public Radio, but is a non-commercial, very much popular music focused non-commercial radio service, in addition to all, of course, stations like Chirp FM in Chicago, which started as an online station, became a low power FM station. We could cite these all afternoon, all day. But I think it's worth noting these are really have taken great root and are spreading. And it's great to hear that you know, East Village Radio Online is coming back as well. There seems to be both the energy and demand.
And I want to add on, Paul, like I know Radio Survivor, we've been recording episodes and talking about radio culture. I don't want to put a number to it because my number's always wrong. But it's over 5 years, nearing 10. And the story at the beginning of our, you know, not, the world has changed a lot since we began talking. And it really is now that when a community radio station goes on the air, 8 years ago, 10 years ago, or at least, you know, when a community radio station went on the air, it was in opposition to a dominant culture of radio. And now I think we've moved past that. And if a radio station is on the air, the dominant culture that it's opposing is probably Spotify. And they're on the air of saying, like, we are not your algorithmically, you know, individually accessible stream. We are a we are here together on the air. And we used to talk about that in the previous decades of our conversations, but I think now it's here. Like, it's a very interesting time to be on the radio.
The buzz in San Francisco, because initially I was wondering, especially about KEXP coming to San Francisco, if that was going to be
controversial. Seattle, yeah, invasion.
Or scary to people, but at least the public-facing comments are all very supportive. And similarly, like, I'm hearing people who are at bigger stations being very supportive of BFF.fm coming on FM. So, you know, I love that. I love that everybody, you know, seemingly is excited that this is bringing attention to radio and sound, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, and if I'm not mistaken, I think KEXP pays its DJs to do the work.
It's a very professional organization in that way, you know, and because there always is this balance between providing opportunities for people who are not radio professionals to get involved in radio, which a lot of community radio and college radio does rather effectively, versus also providing a regular, consistent, you know, somewhat more polished experience. And I love what you said there, Eric. I thought it was really smart. That I think it's really true. I think it's a really keen observation. It's moved away from being in opposition to sort of commercial radio and the radio of the past so much as, like, it's now much more about the radio of the future. And it's and in many ways, I agree with that, that it's sort of, even if we don't name Spotify, but sort of there is a turn back to curation, a turn back to the shared nature of radio, right? Because versus an algorithm versus, you know, whatever I'm getting out of, you know, a streaming service is sort of, it's highly tailored to me, but also there's the feedback loop that I can see and I can hear that I say, oh, I listened to a lot of metal last week and it's giving me more metal now. And sometimes it inhibits discovery, and especially for me inhibits the sort of the left field discovery. Yeah. The thing that like that you can't tell I would like just by looking at what I listened to last week, that is the sort of thing that a great DJ, a great program director puts in front of you. And then when you're listening to a KEXP or a BFF or Freeform Portland, everyone who's listening is getting that same experience, whether it's 4 dozen people, 4,000 or 40,000 people, they're all getting that same experience at the moment, which often people share then online in various ways in which they come together as community. And I think you really kind of are onto something with that observation, Eric, and that we're seeing here with all of this news that Jennifer's kind of helped compile for us to see this trend, because the next thing we're here to talk about, right, is about another big expansion of community radio.
Yeah, so we've been referencing Low Power FM throughout the episode, and there was just another Low Power FM window where people could apply for new Low Power FM licenses. And that window is in December 2023. And so now we're hearing about the licenses that have been granted, and it's been 388 grants for these new Low Power FM licenses in the United States. And just kind of looking through, you know, taking a quick look through all of the stations that were awarded licenses, I was happy to see that there are at least 10 that are at colleges or universities, and a number of them specifically cite that it's going to be for a student radio station. So that's always exciting for me when you hear that young people aren't as interested in radio. So I'm always happy. I like to look at the LPFM statistics to show that young people still care about terrestrial radio in addition to streaming radio, and that it matters to a certain degree.
you know, as background, just to underline why this is important, right? You can't just write a letter to the FCC and get yourself a radio license. So as we sort of previewed earlier, you know, in most major metroplexes, those opportunities for putting a new station on the air are slim to none. So much at a time to put a new station on the air, you actually have to take over an old station in the way that KEXP is moving into San Francisco, because it acquired a station that was being sold at auction, right? That whose assets were being sold at auction due to a bankruptcy is how they were able to start a new station. And so this only happens in what are called these windows, which we just had one in 2023. The last one was in October of 2013.
And this only happens, Paul, I just want to clarify what you're saying is new stations, which is an opportunity for organizations, groups to get on the air for a lot cheaper than buying these stations.
Well, low power FM, yeah, exactly. You don't have to buy them.
The new stations are an opportunity for new things to flourish from tiny sprouts, as opposed to large, well-capitalized nonprofits being able to swoop in and buy broke commercial radio stations.
Yeah,
which is so rare.
Yeah, and in this window, there were 1,336 applications for low-power FM. So there was interest.
Yeah, and we're excited about that because it's so little.
Yeah,
little groups growing.
This is a service that was created 24 years ago, right? The first window to get low-power FM stations was in 2001. So you see, we've only had ever three opportunities for this to happen. And so in a way, it's sort of like a dam breaks, right? Because there is sort of pent up demand in this interim. And then the window opens and people are able to apply. The biggest ever was the 2013 window, in part because there were changes to the rules, which allowed there to be many more stations put on the air, especially in urban areas. They could be a little closer together. That's when we saw a huge influx of stations in San Francisco, Chicago, Los Angeles, other big metroplexes,
Seattle,
and now, you know, in this window, you know, a lot of those stations are taken, which is a good thing that there are stations, low power FM stations operating in each city. So there's a lot fewer opportunities in this one. But it's great to see that even 1,336 applications were filed. And again, there's an opportunity for more community stations like a BFF.FM or additional college stations to go on the air. And you know, it's important and great that organizations took advantage of this, because after this window closes, you know, we don't know when the next opportunity actually will be. But if we're looking at history, we're probably looking at a decade until this happens again, and depending on, you know, how many spaces on the dial may be left.
Yeah, it's a big deal. And during the 2013 window, we did a ton of coverage on Radio Survivor. We kind of followed all the ins and outs of who was applying, who was in competition, and there were a lot of kind of wild, groups that you wouldn't expect who were competing against each other and then later collaborating, which was also very inspiring to see people working together.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, what you have to realize is that when you apply for a specific frequency. You say, I think a station can go on, you know, 102.7 FM, and other folks might apply for the same frequency. And in which case, it's called an MX situation. The FCC has to sort of sort out who should get the license. And the FCC doesn't love doing that, by the way, unless there's a clear winner. And so it what happens is often you can propose to collaborate. And so groups could either join forces and share time, which can mean we get one station gets 12 hours a day, the other station gets another 12, or they can split it up other ways, or they end up just simply building kind of a station together. We've seen different ways. And in other cases, a group has dropped out and said, okay, you know what? This other group should have it for any number of reasons, maybe because they're more well-financed or they have a bigger group of volunteers. It's an interesting situation. But yeah, because there was I can't remember how many applications there were, but I would say it was like a factor of 5 to 10 more, 10 times more than what we saw here in 2023, back in 2013.
There were nearly
significant amount of demand.
Yeah, there were nearly 2,000 awards in 2013, just for perspective, compared with 388 I guess so far. I don't know if they're still rolling out awards for this window.
Yeah, it certainly, I would guess that they're still rolling them out. I mean, it looks like there are still, you know, quite a few in competition, those MX groups that need to be sorted out. And we're getting some of this information from the great RecNet website. Shout out to Mitchie Bradley at recnet.com/window, where she's put online a database where we can see who's been awarded a construction permit and who, where there are competing groups. And also the, I love the garbage button where you can see all the applications that Michi thinks are unlikely or have either been dismissed or were so faulty that they did not stand a snowball's chance of hell of getting a,
I bet you people used ChatGPT to fill out their app. I'm just guessing in a very sloppy and irresponsible way that ChatGPT was put to use on some of these bad applications.
I see one where someone applied for a station at 87.7 FM, which is not
the center of the dial.
It's
below. Yeah, sorry.
It's officially not assignable.
Yeah.
So and that's actually where the Channel 6 Franken FMs.
Yeah, good old Franken FMs. They wanted a Franken FM, Paul. They're Radio Survivor super fans.
So what's great is that Michi has also posted a very long and detailed but amazing analysis of this particular application for WHKA FM in Storrs, Manfield, Connecticut. And so that is one that's not officially a channel you can get a license for in low power FM. So they're not likely to get it. Anyway, that's sort of the fun that we've had. This is a much less, you know, by virtue of there being fewer frequencies available, there's been a little less drama as well this time around, as far as we can tell. But it will definitely be continuing to pay attention to this to see what interesting stations are authorized. And I'm sure, Jennifer, you'll continue to watch what colleges and universities and high schools are able to.
I didn't even look for the high schools this time around. Some of the colleges that have been awarded construction permits are Weber State University in Ogden, Utah, for a student radio organization, Minnesota State in Mankato, Minnesota, that's also for a student radio station, Caldwell College in Idaho, University of Washington, Bothell, which is very interesting because they actually had a low power FM construction permit that they gave up in an earlier window, Eureka College in Illinois, and Marietta College. They're actually going to divest their Class D FM. So they already had a Class D station, WCMO. They're going to divest in order to
operate. So Class D is a 10-watt station. They were licensed from the beginning of FM until the late 70s, in which case they stopped licensing them, the FCC. And everyone who had a Class D station had a choice at that time to either upgrade, hold, or divest. And if you held onto your station, it would be afforded no protection. So if it came around that another station wanted to put on a frequency that would impinge on yours, you would have to give it up. But some people have held onto them over the years. There's very few left at this point in time, but you can't you can't have applied for a new one in close to 50 years now. And of course, 10 watts, you know, is less than 100. So basically, and what's it, and a thing that's important to point out why they have to divest is that in the rules of low power FM, because it's meant to increase diversity on the dial, most organizations are only allowed to own a single low power FM station and not have an interest in any other radio station.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
There is an exception for colleges and universities where if they have, let's say, a lot of universities operate a public radio station that's an NPR affiliate, if they want to put on a second station that is strictly speaking a student operated station, they're permitted to have that low power FM. And I think that's in many cases why some of these applicants have called that out very specifically to make it clear to the FCC. We might have a full power station that's airing All Things Considered. What we want is a student operated station.
Which is great. More radio on campus, the more the better. There are a few other, Berea College Science and Health Foundation in Kentucky got a construction permit. Ave Maria University Land Trust in Florida. Some of these, it's hard to tell, you know, if it's going to be a student station or not. State University of New York in Oneonta and Bard College in New York, which I've heard that's not going to be for the student radio station. It's going to be for another project there. That Bard students have WXBC, which is an online-only station.
Interesting.
How fun. And it's so neat because what's wonderful about Low Power FM is also something, one of its weaknesses. It's not a radio that you can listen to in your car while driving through the city you live in. You can only have it for roughly about a mile, depending on the conditions. And that's just a really wonderful thing for a college, for a campus. The campus community can gather around this 1 mile and really stay tuned into their station. I thought it was also maybe time to grab hold of this segue, because you were mentioning that Low Power FM is only has only been available since 2001, and it was, we know that it, because of Radio Survivor, you know, we've talked about in the past on Radio Survivor that the Low Power FM radio movement, which became available beginning in 2001, grows out of pirate radio culture, in especially in the 90s, where people were demonstrating that there was both a need in the communities for radio stations to go on the air without permission from the FCC, as well as the engineering capabilities that it physically could exist in these niches in these communities. And Jennifer, you've prepared on our run sheet today a conversation about a pirate radio station that now has a Kickstarter for their documentary.
Yeah, so on the show we've definitely talked about 40 Watts from Nowhere, which is this great memoir that Sue Carpenter wrote about running a college radio station. I think initially out of her apartment and kind of
pirate,
just
pirate radio. She starts in college radio, but then she.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay.
Again, I'm college radio on the mind. Yes. Wow, starting a college station out of your house. It's an amazing memoir about kind of that work-life balance. Like, what is it like when you have people coming into the space where you live to do radio? So it's called 40 Watts from Nowhere, and it's going to get turned into a documentary. It's in production. They're doing a Kickstarter for it. The station was called KBLT, and they have vintage footage from the station, like the heyday, I guess, was 1998.
Yeah, and it was on the air in a neighborhood in Los Angeles, which would... you know, the story of gentrification. It was a working class neighborhood that turns into a very desirable hipster neighborhood. In the 90s, it was probably in a transitionary moment where it would be both a desirable neighborhood and an affordable neighborhood. And that's where she founded her pirate radio station.
Yeah, in Silver Lake. And so the documentary is based around this footage from 1998, showing the station operating out of an apartment closet. And so there are people like Mike Watt from Minutemen and Firehose who were there, and Keith Morris from Circle Jerks, Black Flag, other people from The Germs, and, you know, other music fans too. So it sounds like pretty interesting footage that's going to be kind of the central point of this documentary. And they were shut down by the FCC in 1998. They're 12 hours of vintage footage that are kind of forming the framework, and they're hoping to launch it around the time of their 30th anniversary of the station KBLT.
Oh, 30th.
I know. And what's interesting, like, the station had, you know, come into my consciousness again earlier, like within the past year, because there was this immersive experience where it was kind of a theatrical piece where it was like you could go back into the studio of KBLT. And it was also called 40 Watts from Nowhere, this immersive experience that was put together. And it was described as part memoir and part playable theater. And so they had kind of a set where you could go and sit at a DJ booth and talk, select the music to play, and also hear audio as well. So like listening through headphones, you hear Sue's voice. She helps you run the station by guiding you through her apartment and her inner thoughts. So I kind of wonder if this immersive experience, if that kind of helped stoke the coals for maybe we need to actually do a documentary. Because it sounded fascinating. I wish I could have gone down to LA to be part of that immersive theater piece where I was in a fake pirate radio station living the past. So we'll put, oh, go ahead.
Yeah, it's fun. And the book is quite a good read. You know, it came out somewhere in the 2000s, did it? God, I don't remember any longer. I've read it. I have a copy of it, in fact, 41.
I'm going to guess 2013, but maybe 2009.
Yeah. You know, interestingly, I didn't mention this to you all, but I since we're on the Pirate Radio Tip, unlicensed radio tip, I did have a chance to actually go and meet up in person with David Gorin, who is the person, audio documentarist and researcher who is behind the Brooklyn Pirate Radio sound map. He's based in Flatbush, Brooklyn, New York. I was in New York for business a few weeks ago and finally had the chance to meet up in person, get a quick little tour of his radio monitoring station and, do a little bit of a walk around Flatbush, listening into some stations. My time was cut a little bit short due to both meetings and, the public transit from New Jersey being delayed due to trains being stuck in the tunnel underneath the Hudson River. But, you know, otherwise it was fun. I hope I get a chance to meet up with him again. We've talked with David on the show about the Pirate Radio sound map. And I believe that he's also now working with the Library of Congress Radio Preservation Task Force on preserving the sounds of pirate radio in Brooklyn. And for those who are unaware, Brooklyn is one of the hotbeds of unlicensed radio in the United States, used by diasporatic communities primarily. In Flatbush, there's a lot of stations run by people of Haitian origin.
Yeah, a lot of care.
Broadcasting in Haitian Creole, you know, provided as really a community service to their communities.
Yeah, and then some, right? We've learned a lot from David's work about the importance of pirate radio to the communities that use it there in those dense New York City neighborhoods. 40 Watts from Nowhere was a book published in 2001.
Yep. Well, and finally, I wanted to, we did an episode a while back, well, I guess a year ago, about the Wetland Project slow radio broadcast. You might remember it's this 24-hour broadcast that is comprised of audio recordings made at a wetland in British Columbia. And on Earth Day every year, it's become a tradition to air this Wetland Project slow radio broadcast. And the creators of it, they offer it up to radio stations. So it's non-commercial radio stations that play this. And it's it's this invitation to take over your programming with the sounds of nature.
Right. And they offer it in 1 hour chunks, just like they have 24 hours available of these, of the wetland, frogs, birds, planes, animals, the sounds of nature and the sounds of the earth in that neighborhood. But you can also you can take an hour of it. That's what they told us last year.
Yes. If it's too large of a commitment. So We're just,
you can also listen online.
Right. And we're just putting that out there if stations want to participate. In 2023, they had 24 stations, which was a record for them. So we'll put links in the show notes to wetlandproject.com if stations are interested in airing that project for Earth Day. And Earth Day is April 22nd, wow. 2024.
One of my favorite recent episodes of Radio Survivor, of course, yes, it was over 12 months ago that we recorded those interviews, but I replayed it for the radio audience. So if you listen to us on the radio, you might have heard it about a month ago. I put it back into our feed. If you haven't listened to the podcast in a long time, go check out that episode. I'm not going to make up their names. I remember their names almost. Wonderful guests and their conversation about about the philosophy and the artistic practice behind bringing the sounds of this wetland, the nature recordings, the ambient sound recordings captured lovingly and professionally, and broadcasting them on the radio, what it all means and what it can mean, and also how they've taken the work and sort of traveled with it. Like, I love their stories about bringing the sounds of the wetlands to other spaces other than radio and putting on performances with that work. So it sort of ran the gamut of things we love on Radio Survivor that we've been talking about more in the last 5 years, of sound art and broadcast, you know, avant-garde broadcasts. What's the word? Oops. There's a word for when you use radio as your means of transmitting your art.
Transmission arts, yes.
The practice of transmission arts. Really cool conversation. And that episode would be called The Wetland Project here on Radio Survivor's podcast archive. You can dig back for it.
And that was Brady Marks and Mark Timmings, who were the guests on that episode. I won't say the episode name because there's some controversy, or the episode number, because I think it's a different number in different places.
Oh, okay. Jeez Louise.
But yeah, we'll have a link to
Who's
that.
Counting?
Who's counting?
Counting gets so complicated in podcasting.
I know. Somewhere in the 330s.
Well, we here at Radio Survivor, we record both as a podcast and a radio show. And I believe that we've run the gamut of our topics, shockingly, with 2 minutes left to go in our radio program. So we have to fill a little bit. My name is Eric Klein. Here at Radio Survivor, you can listen to us as a podcast wherever you get your streaming radio. But these days, we are not recording new episodes as often as we used to, which is another conversation entirely. But it's been a delight to come back. So you can also listen to all those old shows, over 300 episodes of the program, talking about radio history, radio culture, podcasting, online radio, streaming radio, and the communities that come together around those activities, as well as sound art, all online at radiosurvivor.com. Jennifer Waits produced this week's episode, and the show notes, which are links. Do the kids even know what the internet used to be like, my friends? You used to put links to other websites on your website.
I think they still do, Eric.
They know about links. I know.
I don't think.
But it's changing fast, you know, like,
I
mean,
we used to inscribe things on stone tablets.
The most popular social media apps are not quite really capable of sharing links.
Yeah.
They're not there. It's not about sharing a link to the things. The internet used to be only links.
It's in our bio. Link in bio.
Link in the bio. The reason why the link is in the bio is because the website was designed not to allow you to share links. Then the only place you could put a link was in the bio. So it's like the users of the website sort of had a rebellion of, we need a place to make links. And now there's an entire company based on putting more than one link in the place where you're only allowed to have one link. Guys, thanks for helping me come up with some way to fill the 2 minutes complaining about
old man yells at cloud.
Yeah,
I know.
Old man yells at cloud.
This is the auditory version of the QR code right now.
So links in the show notes at radiosurvivor.com, where this episode we discussed this Kickstarter campaign for the 40 Watts from Nowhere documentary. We discussed the Wetland Project, which radio stations can air, as well as low power FM radio stations and all the rest. So radiosurvivor.com is the website. My name is Eric Klein. Thank you so much for listening. Paul Reese Mandel and Jennifer Waits were with me as well. We'll see you next week.